Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening, and as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com. Welcome to all those in the chat room, my friend Yolanda and my friend Linda, and to all of you listening out there in Blog Talk Land. Tonight's topic is, how does the state see your children? Our enlightened federal government, through the offices of Common Core and data-driven analysis and public education and measuring your child's pulse rate and not permitting them to fail at anything, yet introducing them to adult topics in areas that they're not even going to be able to enjoy if they haven't achieved puberty, is doing its best to create a nation of complacent and compliant, feeble-minded, dependent children. A friend of mine, a very fine friend of mine, Yolanda, who is in our chat room today and is a mover and shaker in Patriot Families, sent me a link on Facebook to a blog post about what they call an exemplar novel that's listed as a choice for reading for high school juniors and seniors. The novel is called The Bluest Eye, and it's written by Toni Morrison, who also wrote The Color Purple, I believe, and it is quite sexually explicit. It disgusted me to the point that I didn't even read all the excerpts, but I am not particularly interested in sexually explicit literature, so I have the choice not to read the book. That is not the case for students in public schools. If it is assigned to them in their English class, they are obligated to read it. As well as the explicit sexual material, this particular novel, basically, according to the author, speaks from the mindset and viewpoint of a rapist and a child molester, with the intent of showing that everybody has problems, and even child molesters think that they are innocent in fondling and engaging in sex with five-year-old little girls. Such literature is considered to be realism, excuse me, cutting the edge, pushing the envelope, and many other literary critics' terms. And it may very well be so. The use of it in a college curriculum where students have achieved their majority, in other words, they are legally adults, and will be exposed to such ideas in both regular psychology courses and abnormal psych. Excuse me. Trying to swallow common core always makes me cough, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway, introducing it or requiring it for college students who are going to be exposed to mature adult content in their courses. Excuse me, is marginally acceptable. However, introducing it to 16 and 17-year-olds whose life experience and whose knowledge of such mentalities is and should be limited is absurd. Yet Common Core appears to want your children to be exposed to every type of sexuality or perversion, depending upon your viewpoint, as a means of indicating that everybody is different and it's okay. In other words, the adult concepts of live and let live or do your own thing, which adults have grown up enough to measure against their own ethics and morality, are being provided to children, literally children, and giving them a view, a distorted view, of what could conceivably be called, quote-unquote, normal for that particular individual. It is the same thing as introducing five-year-olds to the concepts of homosexuality, child molestation as a means of expressing affection, etc. And this exposure, things that adults can often be disgusted by, is considered to be proper and appropriate for a child, a minor. That novel, if it were a movie, the seniors and juniors in high school wouldn't be allowed to enter the movie theater to see it because we have movie ratings that deny access to young people for sexually explicit, R-rated, graphic visual representations. How on earth can anyone with a functioning mind see it as positive in any way to expose these same children to so-called literature that portrays exactly the same scenes they would not be permitted to see on a movie screen? It is the, oh, well, they're too dumb to be able to visualize this, so it's okay if we call it literature. Aside from the absurdity of that, it's another indication of how the Common Core standards want your kids to be too dumb to understand what they read. The whole view of your children and what they need in life that is currently held by those in power in the federal government is appalling. Over and above the nonsensical exposure to matters that children should not be aware of or involved in, the state also deems that your children should not be permitted to grow up except in the matters that pertain to the bedroom. It's okay to have them exposed to and informed about adult activities in sexual matters, but they are not permitted to take the consequences of their actions as children because, oh, it will lower their self-esteem and we don't want to make them feel bad. It doesn't make sense, ladies and gentlemen. The view that the state holds of what your children should be exposed to, should learn, and how it should be presented to them is incredibly distorted. It is a nightmare. The number of kids who would be devastated, their lives damaged by presentation of such things as quote-unquote normal or acceptable, it's frightening. It is absolutely frightening. I was disgusted by the excerpts that I read to the point where after two or three of them, I skipped down to the end of the blog because I am not a fan in any way, shape, or form of this quote-unquote literary genre. I do not enjoy reading about or entering into the mind of serial killers, manipulative, obsessive-compulsive sociopaths, horror novels that graphically display in horrendous acts committed against other human beings or animals. I don't read this stuff. I choose not to because it disgusts and nauseates me. And I'm sorry, my tolerance for alternative lifestyles and behaviors does not include the acceptance of physical torture of humans or animals. I don't read that kind of material. It doesn't interest me. I have no desire to be exposed to it. I am an adult, ladies and gentlemen, and I get to choose what I will and won't see, read, watch. But our children are not adults. And when they are in school, they are subject to the rules of the curriculum and the behavioral standards of the school they attend. If they protest an assigned piece of material, they are not going to be permitted to avoid being exposed to it. Under Common Core, if your state adopts it, your kids, if the teacher and the English department decide that this is the appropriate choice and we're going to read this, your kids are going to be required to enter into and empathize with this really horrible approach to human sexuality. It would be exactly the same thing as requiring your high school junior or senior to read, oh, something even mildly pornographic, such as the good old Forever Band in Boston in the 1930s, Fanny Hill, or Fear of Flying, for heaven's sake, or 50 Shades of Grey, which I have not read also because I don't find sadomasochism and dominatrixes particularly interesting. My friend Yo says it's worse than Playboy, and she's right. It is. Playboy is utterly wholesome, for heaven's sake. And despite the feminist movement of condemning it because it, quote-unquote, objectifies women, and it makes men expect all women to look like Playboy centerfolds, well, if they do, they're going to be disappointed. Too bad. But they're adults. And if they haven't grown up enough to realize that these models are photoshopped and that these women are being held up as an ideal and not necessarily the girl who lives next door, then that is their problem. But to expose our children to these unrealistic ideas, that's why magazines like Playboy and Penthouse are not available with their covers out for everybody, and minors cannot buy them. And yet, Common Core cites this novel as an exemplar, an example of what should be assigned to high school students in OAP, Advanced Placement courses. I do not understand, ladies and gentlemen, how anybody can buy into the current educational philosophy that says it's perfectly okay, fine, and educational and wonderful to expose our children to adult activities. They're not supposed to engage in, okay, without thought and understanding, and yet maintain their supposed childhood innocence by never permitting them to take consequences of what they do. It's this upside-down, inside-out, dichotomous approach that will defeat this nation over time. I do not believe that I have the right to impose my ethics and my morality on another adult if that adult is not harming anyone, taking something which does not belong to him or her, or exploiting someone who is incapable of making adult rational choices. We do not permit child molesters to live within a specific distance of a school. They have to be registered and available to the public because we believe, as a people and as a society, that children cannot give informed consent in sexual intimacy. And by children, it varies from state to state. But generally, anyone under the age of 16 is considered to be a minor child when it comes to sexual liaisons. And high school seniors quite often are under 16, as are juniors. Yet we are exposing them through a supposed, oh, we must expose them to great literature mantra that defeats the purpose of education. When did our public school system become the moral arbiters of how you are to teach your children? The state assumes that children are the property of the state, like that idiot woman who was the spokesperson a few months ago, that your kids belong to the community and not you, as if they were commodities to be traded or bought or sold or enslaved. They are not things, ladies and gentlemen. They're people. They are living human beings with minds, hearts, bodies, and souls. They do not belong to the state. They belong with their parents, if at all possible. I am a firm believer in individual liberty, ladies and gentlemen. But I also believe in individual liberty under Jefferson's statement that so long as it does not break my leg or pick my pocket, you may do as you choose. And as an adult, I take responsibility for my choices. If I do something knowingly that is going to put me in difficulty with my fellow citizens, with the statutory laws, with the ethical and moral principles I was taught, then I will accept the consequences of that choice because I am an adult. I am presupposed to have enough rational and life experience knowledge and be sane under the legal definition to know the difference between what is right and what is wrong. So I am liable for both punishment and reward for my actions. Children are not ready to make the kinds of choices and differentiate between right and wrong when exposed to this viewpoint expressed in Toni Morrison's novel. I can feel, along with disgust, a degree of pity for someone who is malformed enough to believe that sexual liaisons with children is right and proper. But I cannot condone this, nor can I see that individual as having a right to indulge in his or her perversions at the expense of my grandchildren. I do not understand how any parent could be willfully ignorant enough to accept without inquiry the current view of how their child should be educated. We go on a slippery slope more and more, ladies and gentlemen, every single day, under the guise of the liberal buzzwords such as tolerance and inclusiveness and diversity, which no longer have a real dictionary meaning. They mean what the elite say they mean, like Sheila Jackson Lee wanting to rename welfare so it sounds nicer. Words do mean things, ladies and gentlemen, and if we don't teach our children that they do, and that there are such things as right action and wrong action, we will be unable to recognize our nation. We will be living in a quagmire, a sewer, ladies and gentlemen. I don't object to pornography as such because I am an adult and I am knowledgeable and experienced enough and wise enough to understand that pornography is in the eye of the beholder, just as beauty is. I am not subject to the lack of impulse control that most teenage children are. I am not easily persuaded that something that revolts me is actually just fine so long as somebody in authority is doing it. But you cannot say that about kids. My friend Ron says that he's subject to a lack of impulse control, but my friend Ron is an adult, so he has to take the consequences of when he impulsively does something that turns around and smacks him in the teeth, because he's considered to be a mature adult. Our children are not, by definition, either mature or adult. Our children are persuadable and malleable because they are still learning how to become an adult. Our job as educators, as adults, and all adults are educators of children, whether you're a teacher or a parent or an aunt or an uncle or a neighbor or you work in a store, you are an educator of the children with whom you come in contact. And as an educator, your job is to try to present to those children, by example, and not just by precept, what it means to be a good person. Again, that can be in the eye of the beholder. To some people, having, 30 or 40 pets and being unable to actually afford medical care for them, because you just don't have the money, but you dearly love them anyway, and you feed them and pet them and so on, they would see themselves as a good person. To someone else, they would be a bad person, because here they are, you know, with all these pets, and the pets don't get their shots, and so on and so forth, and they might come over and bite my dog, and so, yeah. There are so many gray areas. I don't really like to use the term a good person because of those gray areas, but in general, we as human beings are taught behaviors and attitudes and moral precepts and ethics that will allow us to function as members of a community or a society. And we're taught this from birth, by our parents and our caregivers, because the human animal takes a long time to be able to reach the mental maturity and emotional stability that allows one to make reasoned choices. So children need adults to help them in their choosing, because we have the experience to know that giving little Freddy at age 2 the option to go anywhere he wants in the house could quite easily kill little Freddy, because little Freddy has absolutely no clue that putting your hand on that bright, shiny red place on the stove will hurt you. Or playing in the middle of the street and saying, oh, looky, car, and not getting out of the way, likewise, may kill little Freddy. We accept this with toddlers, ladies and gentlemen. We accept that they need to be smacked on the butt and pulled away out of the street and explained to them in a way that they understand that you don't do this because something uncomfortable will happen to you. And a smack on the butt is a lot more likely to allow them to live long enough to be an adult than having them get run over and then say, see what happens? But we tend to forget, because as a society, we expose our kids to many more adult activities and adult information while still wanting to keep them children than any other society in the history of man. We do not allow our children to take on the adult responsibility of working for pay, for example, until they reach the age of 16. in some places in the world, and sometimes in history, you were considered to be an adult the minute you entered puberty. Which is a really horrifying thought when you stop to think about it, given that 99% of youngsters who just have entered puberty have about as much impulse control as a female cat in heat, or a tomcat who smells her. Yet we say they're mature enough to have a job. We have babied our kids by protecting them from the consequences of their choices in school, by socially promoting them so that their self-esteem won't be damaged and they won't consider themselves a failure. And then we turn around the minute they hit the age of 18 and dump them into the adult world with all of the cushions and bumpers and safety nets pulled right out from underneath them, and get really upset and baffled when they can't cope. We don't allow our kids to fail. So when inevitably they hit a stone wall and they do fail, they fall apart in tiny little pieces of dust and are swept up by the bureaucratic Borg collective. Because we have not allowed them to learn that you can survive a failure. And you can learn from it and succeed more easily because you have learned that failure is not the end of your existence. We train them to believe that there is only one path for them, the path of fulfilling every desire they have. And then when the world does not do that for them, we are surprised and confused and lost in bafflement that they just can't cope, that they can't understand that when you have a job at McDonald's and you don't show up 3 days out of every five, you don't get to keep the job. We keep them in school. We haul them back in when they cut class or are truant or the parents don't care enough to feed them in the morning, in the hopes that we will keep their bodies alive. But we don't do anything to teach their minds and their hearts and their spirit. We make them into tools to be used whatever politician promises to give them something for free. And then we show them through things like The Bluest Eye and quote-unquote literature of that type that anything is okay to satisfy your desires. And you can't help it if what satisfies your desires is considered to be improper, inappropriate, or even bad. You should be allowed to satisfy every desire because we've told them they have the right to this. We have educated them into non-thinking, non-reasoning, non-rational slaves. We have allowed them to become the prisoners of their own passions and desires instead of the masters of those passions and desires. My husband and I used to have interesting discussions about the quote-unquote Vulcan approach to life. For many years, he tried to be Vulcan. It didn't work, of course, because we aren't. And what most of our discussions were about was that logic is all very well, but formal logic depends on the acceptance of the truth of common premises. You can construct a logical argument in formal logic quite neatly, But if your initial premise is not true or contrary to fact, you're still going to wind up on the short end of the stick. And the other side of the discussion, in seeing the Vulcan ideal of the not allowing emotion to enter into rationality, basically subsuming it and making only logical, rational decisions, was that the elimination of emotion means the elimination of humanity. I always liked some of the interpretations of the Vulcan ideology as passion's mastery, not passion's elimination. We are, by our very nature, ladies and gentlemen, beings of body, mind, and spirit. We cannot avoid that. We cannot become mechanical contrivances that operate on a program overseen by a great engineer who pushes this button or types in this phrase, and we immediately respond in exactly the appropriate way because we are programmed to do so. Human beings are non-programmable. We are influenceable. We are malleable. We are trainable, teachable, and educable. But we are not programmable. And in spite of behaviorism and behaviorist psychologists, eventually our humanity comes to the surface. Eventually we subsume or bypass or go beyond our programming. As angry and frustrated and appalled and disgusted as I often get at the direction Common Core and the federal government want to take our public schools, I never completely despair, ladies and gentlemen, because I believe in our humanity. I believe in that tripartite aspect of our natures. And I believe that examples like The Bluest Eye as required reading for high school juniors and seniors may actually wake up enough people so that they will stand up and say, oh, no, you don't. Not with my child, you don't. And if enough of them do that, if enough pebbles start rolling down that hill, the avalanche of positive change will have begun. I am, by nature, an optimist. Pessimists usually don't wind up staying in education for as long as I have, believe me. If you're a pessimist, don't become a teacher, because you'll either be in the booby hatch or leave the profession or both. You cannot teach children if you are a pessimist, ladies and gentlemen. Because if you are a pessimist, you know you are doomed from the start. Because if you're a pessimist, you're going to expect that the children are going to want to learn, be able to learn, gain something from learning, have an interest in learning, and need to learn. And all of them. Every child. And of course, that will not be the case. And you're going to want to see instant gratification. And when they don't learn, or they don't want to, or they have no interest, or they can't, you're going to say to yourself, well, see there? What's the point? And you're going to leave the profession. Because some of them will always fall into those categories. Others will not. And you are not going to get instant gratification. You're going to have your good days when the light goes on over a child's head and all of a sudden he understands that a fraction means less than a whole. And you're going to walk about 12 feet off the deck when you go home at night. But the long-term, lasting, indelible effect that you will have on these children, you will probably never hear about or never know. Unless you are very, very fortunate and remain alive long enough for one of them to come back to you 25, 30, 40 years later and say, I remember what you taught me. Thank you. It happens. It's happened to me. And it's why I still do what I do and why, as an optimist, I will continue to do it until I drop over dead behind my desk in the in-school suspension room. Hopefully that's the way I'll go. And with a little luck, there won't be any kids in there at the time, so I won't frighten anybody. But our current school systems, ladies and gentlemen, nationwide, are being twisted and warped and destroyed from within by the philosophy and policies and mindset of the socialist progressive agenda. If you want to create a socialist utopia, you must do everything in your power to eliminate a sense of right and wrong from the individual. You must subsume the individual's choice and acceptance of consequence of choice to the good of the community, the collective, the whole. Because if you do not do this, sooner or later, the innate individualism, the spirit of humanity, will jump up and bite you in the derriere. And your socialist utopia will fall to pieces, as we have seen happen over and over and over again. My friend Linda just made a comment in the chat room, and she's from California, that the proficiency rates in California schools in math and reading are at about 26%. It does not surprise me. Even as far back as 25, 30 years ago, when I was a private tutor, kids coming into Virginia from California were consistently 3 to 5 grade levels below their actual grade of completion in reading and math skills. We knew in the tutoring firm that I worked for that if they were coming from California and in eighth grade, we'd better make sure that we started them with a fourth grade reading book to try to build up their skills. Across the board. This horrible state of things, ladies and gentlemen, does not have to be permanent. It doesn't. It does not have to be the wave of the future. Waves start with a single motion, the ripple effect. Every single one of you listening to me tonight, whether you're in the chat room or just listening in, you can start to make waves that go against the pernicious dumbing down and subversion of our children. And I say subversion, ladies and gentlemen. If you promise a child that he will be rewarded no matter what his behavior, his effort, or his ability, you promise that child failure as an adult. Because no one in any society known to humankind, past, present, or future, will be able to function once they discover that just existing does not guarantee them everything they desire. Human beings come in all degrees of goodness and evil. Every single one of us has those negative aspects to our character. I have a short fuse. I have absolutely no patience with willful ignorance. I despise deceit, and I hate cruelty. And I will be very impulsive and perhaps say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing if I perceive any one of those things going on. I lose my ability to be a rational, logical woman if I see anybody taking pleasure in causing pain to another living thing. So one day I might very well pick up a rock and bash somebody's head in and wind up in prison for the rest of my life because I acted not out of rationality, but out of emotion. And that makes me a human being. Doesn't make me a good one or a bad one. It merely makes me a human being. My friend Bill said that the current system wants to dumb down the population so that it becomes easier to control, and he's quite correct. And it isn't just in dumbing down academically, Bill. It's dumbing down our perceptions of what is and is not right action. Everybody, as an adult, faces sooner or later in their life a moral dilemma. A situation in which it is difficult to determine what is the right action. It can be a fairly small one, like, do I tell my wife the new dress she bought when she asks me, how does it look? Do I tell her it looks horrible, take it back? Or do I say it's lovely because I see she likes it and feels beautiful in it, even though it doesn't appeal to me? The little white lie, the social politeness, the less than truthful response in order to protect the feelings of someone you care about. That's the standard, easiest example of a moral dilemma. And everybody chooses one side or the other. We do this every day of our lives. We make compromises with our belief in truth and honesty in order to protect the emotional health and well-being of someone we care about. But we accept whatever the consequences are. If I have to stand at the last judgment and say, yes, I told a lie because I didn't want to hurt that person's feelings, and if that condemns me to some eternal punishment, okay, it does. But I'm a human being. This is the way I was created. And I don't believe that that day of judgment is going to condemn me, that my Creator is going to tell me, you are doomed to eternal punishment because you are as I created you. I do not believe that there is a total absence of good or kind impulse in anyone, even sociopaths. However, I do believe that in sociopathic personalities, those who have no ability to empathize, those who have no understanding that it's not okay for them to gain pleasure through hurting others, I do not believe that people who do these things should be permitted the freedom to continue to do them. I do not believe that it is right or just to encourage anyone to take advantage of another being to that being's detriment in order to satisfy their desires. I believe that our society has to have moral and ethical standards. Otherwise, it cannot function. Right and wrong are quite often in the ethos of individual societies. An excellent example is a clip I heard on television today, an advertisement for a show that was talking about some 30,000 high school age kids in Islamic countries being trained in jihad. Or the belief among some followers of Islam that it is glorious, just, and right to don a suicide vest and kill yourself so long as you take an infidel or two with you. I don't share that belief. I believe that it is wrong to punish the innocent for the actions of those who have power over them. But I also understand the concept of a just war. And in war, the innocent are often punished. Another moral dilemma, ladies and gentlemen, an ethical conundrum. Every single day that we live, we face these moral dilemmas. And part of our job as adults, and thus educators of children, is to try to approach them as clear-eyed and upright as we can. And by doing that, teach our children by example that they too will face moral dilemmas. They too will sometimes have to make choices in situations where it looks as if there's no right choice. And we can do this if we prepare them. While we can still protect them, by allowing them to experience the consequences of choices that are not correct or appropriate. A couple of years ago, I believe, I talked on this show about what happened to my younger grandson. At that time, he was my youngest grandson. When his behaviors in class were inappropriate, such as throwing tantrums, biting people, hitting other students with chairs, etc., his teachers were taking him aside, giving him a lollipop or a candy, playing a game with him so he could, quote-unquote, calm down, and then re-entering him back into the classroom. This was in second and third grade, first and second grade. And my outrage and his mother's outrage when she found out about it. Because behaviors like that were not tolerated at home. They were not rewarded with something that tasted good and an activity he found enjoyable. They were punished by negative consequences to him. And by those negative consequences, he was learning that those behaviors were going to be counterproductive because whatever joy he got out of them, he paid for with double the misery later. Babies are not born with morality and ethics, ladies and gentlemen. It is our job as adults to teach these things to children. Just as if we have fur beings as part of our families, as pets, cats, dogs, mice, hamsters, gophers, whatever they are. We teach and train them behaviors that are appropriate indoors. Because we want them to be companions and family members without making the place where they lived unhealthy or filthy for everybody else. If we are responsible pet owners, we train them judiciously. We do not take joy in hurting or beating them. We do not play with them roughly until, like a dog, and then never correct them for rough play, and all of a sudden they're a year and a half old, they weigh 60 pounds, and they still want to bite you. If we understand this about our companion animals, why are we stupid enough to think we don't have to do this with our children? I do not believe that the answer to every childish misdemeanor is a beating with a strap or a switch. That's kind of like taking a howitzer to kill a flea, when all the kid did was forget to put his clothes away at the end of the day. I don't advocate corporal punishment as the only way to discipline and teach a child. But neither do I say that it should be eliminated completely and considered abusive. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, liberal progressives, most of which are teaching in our universities, do not understand gray areas. They live in a positive-negative, black-and-white, blueprint sort of world. You either are them or you are not, are anathema. The vilification of the people who they see as their enemies because they happen to lie somewhere else along the political spectrum should be a clear enough indication. The pejorative and downright disgusting language used by many liberal commentators and liberal politicians to describe those who have opposing views as to the direction this nation should go should disgust anybody with a functioning brain. It's very much the kids in the sandbox fighting over the truck and calling each other names until somebody runs away and cries. But I have long believed that liberal progressives never actually got past puberty anyway, at least not mentally. Physically, possibly. The way that they make everything about women's issues having to do with our reproductive organs is they did enter puberty. It's, you know, we are being our kids, our girls in particular, are basically being told that the most important thing about their lives is their reproductive system. And that women's rights begin and end with, I want to go to bed with anybody I please and not have any consequences afterwards. And this is liberation? No. It's not. It's libertinism. It has nothing whatsoever to do with freedom. It has to do with the inability to recognize and control your own passions and desires. You shouldn't have to. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you should. You should learn to keep your legs together. You should learn to value yourself enough that you see more to yourself than your lady parts, so to speak. The progressives don't see women like me as anything other than reproductive organs. They're not at all worried about me because I'm no longer capable of reproduction. But young women who are still malleable and still inclined to do what everybody else does because they'll be uncool if they don't, are being fed exactly the same kind of garbage, only in a different package, as the Victorian idea that the only function a woman had was to have babies and keep house. Progressives still see women as reproductive systems. The women's issues that they talk about are 99% of the time about abortion, birth control, Planned Parenthood, and 1% of the time about equal pay for equal work. The whole system, ladies and gentlemen, has become so corrupted by the packaging of ridiculously untenable and impossible to achieve socialist utopian dreams that it's a wonder we still produce people who eventually will be the Dr. Benjamin Carsons and the Martin Luther Kings and the George Washingtons of the future. But we do produce them, ladies and gentlemen. We still do have youngsters who will grow up to be movers and shakers and progressive in the real literal meaning of the word. Not in the political, pretty wrapping, rotting corpse of so-called progressivism. It's our job to stand up and speak out against Common Core, investigate exactly what the standards require, what materials are going to be presented, understand what they mean by data-driven evaluation of your child. Progressives cannot admit the existence of the human spirit, because if they do, every one of their prettily packaged boxes of maggots will be exposed for exactly what they are. Progressives must make spirit, soul, the desire to be better tomorrow as a person than you were today. They must at all costs stamp out these ideas, because it is these ideas in the minds and hearts and spirits of individuals that will ultimately bring down their pathetic houses of cards. It is our individuality, ladies and gentlemen, that is our saving grace. It is our ability to create, as we are made in the image of the Creator, and to create, you have to have freedom. And if you have freedom, you have the freedom to fail as well as succeed. Because without the freedom to fail, there is no freedom at all. We cannot allow a belief that life can be made risk-free by government to destroy us from within. Being alive is a risk. Bringing new life into the world is a risk. Because once you have a child, you have a hostage to fortune. You have a being who is entirely dependent upon you. They literally cannot exist anymore without you. This is a huge responsibility, ladies and gentlemen. And this is what we should be teaching our young men and young women. Not, oh, you don't have to accept this responsibility. You can have your fun and you can just get rid of it. Because we can't expect you to be responsible for your actions. Because if you're responsible, well, then you're not free to have everything you desire. And unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, children are vulnerable to this. Purely and simply because they have not yet had the life experience. They have not yet matured mentally and emotionally to be able to understand and accept the fact that sometimes you can't have what you want right now. But our public school system is doing the opposite. And anyone who tries to point this out is vilified as a child abuser, an uncaring, unfeeling monster. How dare you allow that child to feel so bad because he didn't do his homework and didn't study for a test and he got an F? How can you condemn that poor child to thinking that forever in his life he will never be of use because he got an F in social studies in sixth grade and his life is ruined forever? No, it's not. But we have allowed ourselves to fall into the trap of believing that if our children are not exactly like other children in the way they learn and progress, then there is something inevitably wrong with them, and they're never going to have a success, they're never going to be able to be viable, and we are guilty because we produce them, and obviously we must have done something wrong or have bad genetics because little Johnny got an F in social studies. And oh Lord, what will I tell the folks at the country club? Progressives know how to play on emotion, ladies and gentlemen. Their chief political tool is discontent. And they're very, very good at creating professional victims. When I was in my 20s, the so-called women's liberation movement was all the rage and very fashionable. I thought it was a bushel basket full of the stuff you sweep out of a stable myself, because I never felt that I was enslaved to begin with. I wasn't taught that I was a lesser being because I was female. Ever. By either of my parents. Catholic school tried to teach it to me, but it didn't work because the what I learned at home made much better sense. But then I was taught, ladies and gentlemen, I was taught that with effort and application, I could choose my path. And it was up to me. Me. Not my teacher, not my mommy, not my daddy, not my friend, not my BFF forever or whatever, but me to put forth the effort and the application. If I wanted to succeed, I had to try. And if I didn't succeed at first, I had to try again. Looks like I have a caller, folks. Hang on a minute. We'll see who's on the line. Hello.
Hi, Miss Terry. It's Linda.
Hi,
here
Linda.
In good old California.
20, you know, good old 26% proficiency California, right?
Oh, my gosh. Well, this is the public schools. Now, what's happening here in San Diego County and also in Los Angeles, these people are trying to get these charter schools opened, and they have to jump through all these hoops. Well,
oh, yes.
And they get denied more than they should. And the reason is because this was explained on Mike Slater's show today.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that denied this application for this, or the pushing it all the way through, was I guess he's on one of the school boards, but because they have all these different levels, because they have the county board of supervisors, they got this, so you got to go through all this nonsense. And he was a denier, and he is also a president of one of the labor unions, which includes the teachers union. How the hell that's even legal, I don't know. But this is what you're up against, because charter schools are not union, even
that's
in California.
Correct. That
that's
is correct.
Why that's why they're trying to put the kibosh. So what Mike Slater's doing is going to have a call to action, because the people who wanted to get this one in the center of Mission Valley or someplace down here, closer to San Diego proper. And they're not giving up just because this one. They're going to go to the County Board of Supervisors, which is this San Diego County board. And I don't know if that's in a couple of months or whatever it is, but it's going to be posted on Facebook by Mike Slater. Mike Slater's all over the place, you know, with his radio show. And people are going to come by the hundreds to that meeting. And they're going
wonderful.
To be. Yes. So we can make a difference.
Yes, we can.
You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. So
we can.
What people have to start doing is just say we're not doing this anymore.
Exactly. That's what I'm when I talk about the human spirit triumphing over these kinds of ideas, Linda. That's what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
We have, by grace of God, the ability to stand up and say no. I'll be damned if you will.
Yes, that's
and
correct.
It is that part of our nature. That, I guess you could say, did you ever read A Wrinkle in Time?
No, I haven't done that one.
Okay. All right. It's a children's book written by Madeline L'Engle. And one of the main characters, one of the protagonists, is a young girl who is basically not super popular. She's stubborn. She doesn't go the way everybody tells her to. And she is trying to rescue her father from Durance Vile and is aided in this by some spiritual beings. And she and another protagonist are sent to try to rescue her dad. And these beings, guardian angels, if you will, give each of them a gift that will help them achieve what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, and the gift she is given, the guardian spirit says, "I give you your faults."
Wow.
Her stubbornness, her unwillingness to just say, okay, her desire to question, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right.
Mm-hmm.
It is that quote-unquote fault. And under progressivism, those are faults. It is those faults that will inevitably triumph.
Correct. So that's why I wanted to share that with you, because even though the numbers were so dismal lately, people are saying, you know, I'm sure that as a result of those situations and that their own children are may probably suffering under this, then there's a call to action, and they're going to say, we want the charter schools. We want something to where we have more control over what's being taught and how it's being taught and the teachers that are going to be there. And so this is why this is happening. And I think that back in 08 at the election, and, you know, the Tea Party was formed. We never had a Tea Party before because this clown that usurped that office woke a lot of people up. He's the best thing for gun sales I've ever seen.
Oh, my God,
He
really is. And he's we are no longer an apathetic nation who trusts their government implicitly, which to many people is, oh, that's terrible. No, it's not. Our founding fathers are proud of us because they didn't trust government either. That's the way they wrote. That's why they created the Constitution the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point was it was supposed to be a restriction on government, not a restriction on citizens. It's not a charter of negative liberties. It's a charter of positive liberties. It negatively...
For we the people.
Yes, not the government. And they knew...
That's why the dictators hate it. Of course.
Yes. That is exactly why progressives hate it and why supposed constitutional scholars like the object in the Oval Office can't stand it. Because
the only thing he ever learned how to put on a chalkboard was Saul Alinsky.
Yeah, pretty much. I am so grateful that I grew up when I did, because I didn't get the Kool-Aid from age 5. Okay.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And our kids are getting it, Linda. I mean, absurdity of exposing them to stuff like Toni Morrison's book.
That wouldn't
be able at 17 or 16 when they're in high school, when if they made a movie out of it, the kids wouldn't be allowed to see it.
Oh my God. You know what? This is criminal, and if people don't start, if they don't be up in arms over this, I would fault the parents as co-conspirators. Oh my
and
Lord.
I'm sorry, her supposed apologia or reason for writing it the way she did was to express that everybody has problems. Yeah, but you know, my problems aren't molesting 8-year-olds. That's not a problem.
That's
a crime.
Look, you know what this is, where this is headed, and why they're doing it. This is not just the dumbing down. This is part of the tenets of the Communist Manifesto, that you must make these kids believe that all of these perversions are normal. This was written by Kermit a long time ago.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Oh, of course. And it makes excellent sense, because when you have people who are more inclined to listen to an authority above you, your power over them is subsequently exponentially diminished. So that's one of the reasons why communism was so against religion and spirituality, the opiate of the masses. Because when you believe there is a higher power to which you are accountable, all of a sudden the state isn't quite as scary as it was. And you're not quite as willing to sit back, open your mouth, and say, feed me. Even if I have to sit here and muck up to my lips, feed me, and I'm happy. I love this stuff that I'm sitting in.
And that's
just as I get
fed.
That's why
it's good that we use proper terminology. We can say progressives, although that's kind of a perversion by these people. The way Mark Levin talks about the entire thing. You just take the isms out of it and just call them statists, because they are all about the state. It's all-encompassing.
Well, you can thank good old Hillary for her, I am proud to call myself a progressive, basically using the historical accuracy of the progressive movement in the early part of the 20th century, which was basically an attempt to come closer to the idea of equal opportunity for all, even if they weren't born here, and perverting it to the kind of socialist Marxist garbage that she spouts.
Right.
And I'm sorry, if Margaret Sanger is not my hero.
Right.
Race, bigoted,
and I think,
nasty old witch.
I think good old Hildebeest is confusing things and probably hasn't read her history lately, because I believe it was the Bull Moose Party with Teddy Roosevelt, and then they called it the Progressive Party.
Yes, they did.
And she's glomming on to all those Fabian socialists. That's what she should have called herself, because that's who she's admiring.
All of them. And, okay, if you ever read Jean Webster's novel, Daddy Long Legs?
No. I've
published
been reading too much.
Yeah. Well, this is a novel. Jean Webster was a Fabian socialist herself. She died very young, but she wrote two novels that were really good stories. Daddy Long Legs, which was made into a ridiculous movie with Fred Astaire that had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the book. And then the sequel, Dear Enemy. And throughout both books, the Fabian socialist philosophy is, you know, it goes all the way through them. Now, I enjoyed the books. I read them when I was in my 20s for the story. And even I could see this, that, you know, the idea that now if we could only make it so that sociopathic individuals who are genetically predisposed to us wouldn't be allowed to breed, in other words, eugenics, kill off anybody who is a detriment to society so they can't breed copies of themselves to be a detriment to society, which is flat out Adolf Hitler.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He got his ideas from American and English Fabian socialists. That's where his, exterminate the evil race of Jews came from.
Mm-hmm.
And his propagandists learned their trade from us.
Oh, I know. That was Bernays. And,
yep.
And of course, that's what Goebbels had on his desk.
Exactly.
Well,
and, you know, people... Because they are not being allowed to think. Our kids are not being taught to think, Linda. They're being taught to gulp down things, spit it back out on a test, and then forget they ever saw it.
Exactly.
The number of children that I have who say to me, Mrs. Rowland, how do you remember all that stuff? Well, I remember it because I was taught it, and I knew I was supposed to remember it. That's why it was being taught to me. They have they do not understand that learning something means retaining it.
Oh, man. I know.
Because they'll tell me, oh, well, we learned that last year, but I don't know how to do it anymore. Then you didn't freaking learn it, child.
Nope. And if you don't continue to practice or utilize it, especially
it
that little muscle called the brain.
It's going to get rusty just like your bike if you leave it out all through the winter and never ride the doggone thing. And the number of kids that, if nothing else, Linda, in what I do, I have a bully pulpit, to quote good old Teddy. He did have a way with words, even though he was something of an idiot politically. But anyway, I have a bully pulpit because I can impose upon them a set of behaviors that are acceptable in a classroom. My classroom rules, which are considered punishment, are the classroom rules that I grew up with in a standard, everyday, ordinary classroom.
Right. And you and I were very fortunate to at least catch that portion of education in the public schools that weren't so evil as they are today. And so detrimental. I think they're just detrimental to the children. To me, it's just criminal. By the time I was even in seventh or eighth or ninth grade, we had, especially in high school, we had the option to take drama class if we wanted. And I loved it. So I took it.
Yeah.
I took speech. I took English lit. I took everything I could on my plate. And when you do the dramatics, and you do, whether it was Shakespeare, and it happened to be Macbeth, and I was Lady Macbeth, of course, for the classroom assignment.
I did the sleepwalking scene for my senior project.
Yeah, how fun. And so to do a soliloquy, you have to literally memorize,
everything.
That you can do it while you're brushing your teeth without even thinking about it. And that's why it was a wonderful tool to also help you when you read to retain whatever. It doesn't matter whether it would be that or
The other aspect of drama training that is so good, Linda, is not just the training of memorization skills, which are absolutely important, but learning drama, taking a course in it, pulls together both aspects of learning that you have to have. Not only the memorization skills to remember the lines, but the understanding of what they mean. You can't convincingly perform as Lady Macbeth if you don't understand. understand what she means when she's standing there going out, damn spot, ah, one, two, why then 'tis time to do it. Who would have thought the old man had so much blood in him? You can't do it unless you understand what it means.
Well, it's definitely that particular aspect of life, or those who choose to be the thespians. You're using both sides. I mean, you've got the right left brain going full speed ahead because it's very creative. That's what dancers do.
Yeah, I did that scene. I did that scene, let's see, 50 years ago. 50.
Wow.
I was 17, okay? I'm 67 now. And I could refresh it and do it again tomorrow if I had to.
If you had to, yeah.
Yep.
Well, I don't know if I'm that good, but yeah, I could do portions. I might not be able to do the entire bit, but, you know, a few paragraphs here and there. But
well,
it stays with you. Yeah.
I had that from my dad, who was an amateur thespian. He was in dramatic society in high school and performed as in an amateur theater company. And he memorized Hamlet's soliloquy and recited it to me when I was like 12 or 13. And he was 33, and he had done it as in his English class in high school 20 years before that.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, so I inherited a darn good memory, thank God.
Yeah,
but
good. Well,
anybody,
I know you're going to wrap it up in a second because you're running out of time. Yeah. And thank you so much for letting me rant. But I'm glad we're going to do
it. It's always a pleasure,
sweetie.
And I am spiritually with everybody who is attending that gathering. And please tell them that there's somebody in Virginia that's applauding them madly for standing up and saying, "Not with my child,
you
don't."
Okay, hi.
Thanks,
see you in the chat room.
Thanks for calling in.
Be blessed.
I'll be here. Ladies and gentlemen, that was my friend, that beautiful bird of paradise, that rare bird of paradise, the California conservative. And do tune in for Linda's show every Wednesday night. We do these shows, ladies and gentlemen, not because we want to be famous. God knows I have no desire whatsoever to be famous. I like my privacy. But I do this every week, if I possibly can, because I believe in the values I was taught by my parents and the values I learned from our founding fathers. That what makes a nation great is not its ability to cow other nations, but its ability to provide freedom for its own people. Our greatness doesn't lie in the influence we have in the wider world. Our founding fathers weren't interested in that at all. They did not want alliances and treaties other than trade. Okay? They did not want to be allied with anybody else, but they did want to trade with them, to share the good things of life in an equitable way, good for good. They understood that humans need freedom to make real progress. And freedom is dearly bought. I believe in freedom, ladies and gentlemen, and I believe in you. And that's why I'll be back here again next Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Patriot Education. And that's why I urge all of you to visit our website, www.patriotfamily.com. And get to know the people who are standing up for the values that you and I grew up with. I'll say good night, ladies and gentlemen, and as always, all my love to my greatest fan. Thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. God bless.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.